we call it a recalibration. And then there's that saying, like, we have to get up now. Like, you can't sit on the sidelines. It's like, it's enough.
There are no sideliners today anymore.
Right.
Because you may not personally relate,
right,
but your grandchildren will hold you to account.
I'm really excited for our first podcast here, and we are honored to be having with us Malcolm Honlein, who is a living legend, and he'll be with us soon. But before we meet with Malcolm, we wanted to share with you what this podcast is really about, what its genesis was, so you all can have a great understanding. After October 7th, really on October 8th, what we saw on social media and we saw on the streets really surprised us. It shook us. And it wasn't so much the people who acted in ways we could predict that surprised us, but rather people who acted, regular, ordinary Americans, so to speak, acting in ways and doing things that surprised us. And it really shook us to our core. And that was really the beginning of our recalibration. It's important for me to explain a little bit about myself. Between 1998 and 2002, I went to NYU, and that was during the Second Intifada. And during that time, I was an activist, a student leader. We began a group called Torchback. And during that time, we did all kinds of protests and rallies, letter-writing campaigns, news, media. And we were quite effective in sharing the positive stories about Israel and dislodging fake narratives, false narratives. And then in 2002, I graduated and I moved on with my life. And I was in the private sector for the last 21 years, up until October 8th, when what I described happened. And I understood that I could not afford to sit on the sidelines any longer. Up until then, I had always been interested and cared a lot about Jewish causes and Israel in general. But I essentially was what they call an armchair general. Lots of opinions and thoughts, no action. And then on October 8th is when I realized that, again, I couldn't afford to sit on the sidelines. And I became recalibrated, so to speak. I understood I had to jump back into this effort. And along the way, we've met lots of people, individuals, and organizations who have reacted in similar ways. And they themselves have become recalibrated. And it's really incredible when we think about how many different startups have emerged, how many individuals suddenly feel a purpose, suddenly have a cause that they can believe in, suddenly feel a new connection to their Judaism, towards a connection to other Jewish people. And it's really a story, it's an underreported story. We've heard a lot of negativity about what's going on in the world in general, in Israel, in the West, and there's not been as much about the positive things. And nothing can take away from the tragedy of October 7th or the anti-Semitism so many people have experienced both on campuses and around the country. But it's also worth mentioning all the positive things that have come, the recalibration that has emerged. And we're excited to meet with Malcolm Honlein because he sits at the cross section between many of these different efforts. And it's going to be quite interesting to hear from him. And I'm going to share with you something that Aaron and I have been working on and how our recalibration has manifested itself. After October 7th, on October 8th, we understood that so many people were being sort of miseducated on social media with false narratives. And we understood that social media is playing a massive role in shaping the minds and the hearts of all people, but specifically young people. We made an assumption that there's a minority of people who are very organized and very loud on social media, but that the whole country basically was watching, observing social media. And if we didn't create an organized way to amplify our voices on social media, we would be leaving a void for that small minority of organized people to fill the void and thereby give the impression to the rest of the country that everyone was anti-Israel. So we decided that we were going to begin something new because we didn't see it there. We wanted to fill this void. And our goal was to create a network comprised of millions of people, both Jewish and non-Jewish, to work in a coordinated way to amplify our voices on social media. And when my wife and I first conceived of this idea. We had this idea of creating social media warriors. Now, we've changed a lot of the terminology, right? But that was our initial conception. And I called my rabbi, Rabbi Fink, and I said, Rabbi, I have an idea. Can I come speak to you? And he said to me, I thought he was going to say, yeah, come next week between Thursday, between 6 and 6:05. He didn't do that. He said, come right away. Come right now. So I jumped in my car. I ran down to the synagogue, and I was talking to him for 10 minutes, and he said, Daniel, I'm in. And Aaron, what's our favorite phrase?
I'm all in.
Right. So he said, I'm all in. Come speak to my synagogue now, tomorrow. I said, no, Rabbi, we have to build this now. We have to build this. And so Aaron and I have been good friends for a long time. We've been connected in many different ways. And the next phone call I made was to Aaron. I said, Aaron, we have to do something. And I didn't have to say much more. He understood also, and he's going to share some of his understandings in a moment. And so I right away called him, and we together embarked, and we've been partners in this from the beginning, on this journey to create a organization, and it's grown, and it's emerged into something that's quite interesting at this time. So we began, we created a team made up of Rachel Azaria, former Knesset member, Brigadier General, retired Brigadier General Omer Dagan, from Israel, from the LOTEM, which is the intelligence community, Sandy Cardin, and Marjan Greenblatt, Jan Kitterman, Zev Sherl, and together, did I miss anyone?
Zalmi.
And together we began this this effort. So we began working for about 10 months together as minds and hearts, and 8 months ago, we came into contact with another group of people who were also recalibrated after October 7th, who were called Emissary. And after October 7th, Dave Crystal and Dave Burton decided to start Emissary, understanding the same thing that we understood. And so about 8 months ago, we met and we decided to merge and become one organization. And so with Emissary and Minds and Hearts, we became Emissary with the tagline, Inspiring Minds and Hearts to Combat Anti-Semitism. And in the last 8-9 months, we've been working together very strongly. And essentially our goal is to create a network where people can come together to amplify their voices. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Aaron to share one of or two of his stories.
Sure. So again, my name is Aaron Herman, and I've worked in the Jewish philanthropic world for almost 20 years. And also worked in the startup world. I was like one of the first Jewish vloggers before the influencer age. I saw the importance of storytelling through video. And, for me, October 7th was something that we kind of like knew things were difficult in the Middle East. But this trauma that October 7th had onto all of us, everyone felt it in different ways. And when I say that is that I have a 5-year-old son, and it's funny when Dan and I were talking about this, I said I actually never shared this story before with anybody. So on October 7th, we were getting dribs and drabs of what was happening, and then my friend ran over to my house and told me like what was happening in Israel at the time. Actually, my sister-in-law was in Sderot at the time, he's like that. Now thank God she's out. And then the images, the pictures, the video, it just, for someone who consumes a lot of social media, like those videos, it was like that emotion that everyone had, like this is happening when you saw the. What was happening at the Nova Festival and the paragliders and all these these GoPro images, and it was just, for me, it was like it's like a sensory overload, and that night, I always put my son to sleep, and I was just I gave him an extra hug, and I felt like I need to protect him, right, because of the sensory overload. Like I was seeing all these images, and it kind of got worse as we started learning more and more what was happening. And as Dan mentioned, when he gave me the call, when him and his wife Lila had this big idea, he said social media warrior. And for me, that wasn't a new idea. It wasn't like a new term, keyboard warriors, social media warriors. But during this time, everything shifted. You know, having worked in the community and seeing how things are kind of like built and worked, and I saw that a lot of organizations also were going through their own trauma. They didn't know how to like respond. Everyone was doing their own thing. And so when we started to talk about this idea of one network, empowering people, making a difference, that was something that for me was unique. And A, Dan's my friend, and when Dan calls, we've had a lot of discussions over the years, some very heated about different things, you know, with different ways of how the Jewish community should act or shouldn't act. But the passion that this man has can inspire you.
So there's a lot more that we want to talk about yeah. Emissary and, yeah. and what's happening and what's going to be. But right now we're so honored to have with us what I call a living legend, someone who has given at least 5 decades, maybe more,
six decades
to helping the Jewish people defend themselves and advocate for the Jewish people. And it's just, I feel personally very blessed to know you, Malcolm.
My pleasure. And it's great to know you and all the great work both of you are doing and what Emissary is and will be doing.
Thank you. So just quickly, how I met Malcolm, I came to an event and I got there early, and I'm not the type to just run up to people, but I saw there standing this man who I've been watching and listening to and reading for the last 25 years, just, you know, happened to have a minute when someone wasn't up talking to him. And I said, I have to at least introduce myself to this person. So I walked up to Malcolm and I said, Malcolm, I just want to say thank you to you for everything you've done.
Yes, you did.
And I was a little bit starstruck, if I might say, because I had been working on this Minds and Hearts thing. And I just said, I want to say thank you. And Malcolm says, who are you? What are you doing? I'm like, I'm nobody. I'm just someone who just wants to say thank you. And then at the end of the session, I said, oh, that's right. I am doing something. We're working on this thing to help the Jewish people. And so that's how we began our sort of call it professional relationship. And so I really want to thank you for coming. It means the world to us. Most people know who Malcolm is, but in case you don't, he was the executive vice chair for the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations from 1986 to 2020. He was the founding executive director for the Jewish Community Relations Council, the JCRC. He was the founder for the Greater New York Conference on Soviet Jewry. He played a huge role in helping Soviet Jewry become free. He has awards. He just recently received an award. I have to read it because there's so many. The Israeli Presidential Medal of Honor just recently in Israel in 2025, excuse me. The Menachem Begin Prize. He's the Private Sector Initiative Award presented by President Ronald Reagan. The American Ort Man of the Millennial Tribute. He's been an advisor to many presidents. He's just an incredible living legend, as I say. So welcome.
Thank you. And welcome. It's great to be with you. And God willing, a future legend.
There we go. So that leads us to our first question. So maybe you could share with us a little bit what got you started with helping to advocate for the Jewish people six decades ago, and also what inspires you to continue doing so.
Well, it began 7 decades ago, actually, when I was very young. And honestly, the Shoah played a big role. I was born at the end of the Shoah, but my grandparents and most of our families were killed. And at a very young age, I realized that if Jews were to survive, we couldn't do it at the sufferance of others. We had to control our own fate. And that meant getting involved politically. And at the age of 10, I got involved in a Senate race in Pennsylvania, where I lived. And in...
What did you do at 10? I'm just curious.
I worked with Senator Joe Clark's campaign. And when I was... 2 years later, I got into the hotel room of Adlai Stevenson, who was a Democratic candidate for president. And he was sleeping, and his sons saw me, and they took in this little kid with the yarmulke. And... then Adlai Stevenson invited me to travel with him for 2 days on his campaign. And I did many other things over the years while I was in school and through my high school education in Yeshiva and subsequently. And then on campus, when I came, I organized the Philadelphia Union of Students, which became the National Union of Jewish Students for the first time, and got involved with the World Union of Jewish Students. And I will tell you honestly, I can take no credit for any of the things that I accomplished, because everything happened to me. And I believe that, you know, God gave me very few talents. I can't write, sing, dance, draw, anything. I don't play any instruments. He gave me a few talents, and thank God gave me the opportunity to be able to use them for what I cared about most. That people like you who have businesses and other things have to work on the things you care about in your spare time. I was privileged through my whole life and my whole career to do it full time. But honestly, I never looked for a job. It just, things, opportunities came. I'm not saying that, I mean, I had many opportunities outside of the Jewish community, but I knew what I wanted to do. And I feel that this is my expression of never again, that it's not a hollow phrase, that it's a pledge that each generation has to take anew. And that I had the opportunity, I got involved in the Soviet Jewry movement from its very beginning. I went on radio in Philadelphia when I was like 17, 18, debating those who did not want to see us take an activist approach. And I worked for the Jewish community in Philadelphia while I was finishing my doctorate and working as Middle East.
Like other Jewish people slash organizations thought
we should not take a public stance.
Right.
We should, you know, that. And there were some who did it legitimately, and they were because they weren't involved. There are others who just didn't believe in Jewish activism. And we learned the lesson of what happens when Jews are not active. When Jews don't stand up to defend their own rights, others will join us, but we have to be there first. And that was true in Soviet Jewry. We built coalitions in every sector, from Black Coalition, science, doctors for Soviet Jewry, every group, but only because we were there first and we were in the streets and we were taking a responsible approach, but an activist approach to the issue. And I came to New York to meet Jacob Birnbaum, who was head of the student struggle at the time, and then I was asked to come to New York to start the conference on Soviet Jewry in New York in 1971, after I had been arrested in Russia, where I went on a shlichut, on a mess, my wife and I.
Could you share, for some people who don't know, what the issue was with Jews?
Well, Soviet Jews, there were 3 million Soviet Jews who were denied their rights for 70 years under communism, denied the right to live as Jews, and our campaign was, let them live as Jews or let them leave as Jews. But the goal was actually, obviously, to get them to come to Israel and elsewhere. And the, these were the remnants that after World War II, when the Iron Curtain slammed down on them, they were the next victims of the Holocaust, because they were denied their rights. And Stalin obviously killed many Jews and restricted their rights. And we believed, and it was inspired by the people in Russia. We did not impose our will on them. They set the example. They hijacked the airplane. They saw Shurinsky, saw all these others, not heroic figures in and of themselves, who turned out to be heroes, and who stood up against a prison that spanned two continents. They turned the Iron Curtain into a Venetian blind. They made Glasnost possible. They made Perestroika possible by their heroism, by what they did. They broke open the Russia, the Soviet Union, and made this new era possible. We still have many Jews in Russia, but they are free. Their synagogues function. Doesn't mean they don't face anti-Semitism and some difficulties, but overall, the communities function and they have a full Jewish life. And thank God, almost 1 million have come to Israel and are responsible in large part for the Startup Nation phenomenon, the miracle, because they brought talents and skills to Israel. And we have a large community here in the United States. So that was one of the causes. And obviously, I was privileged to play a role in the rescue of Syrian Jewry, a different place. I even met with Assad in Damascus for 3 hours. I played a role on Iranian Jewry, getting them out. And when the Iran 13 got arrested, I organized the worldwide effort. And again, thank God we got all of them out. The first time since the revolution, when every year one or two Jews were killed. We know three of them were marked for death and 10 for long prison terms, but thank God all of them got out, and I negotiated with some of the names that you see from the Iranian government and many other cases like that. And there's no reward greater than that, that you can look back, you can make a lot of money, you can have other great successes. There's nothing greater than knowing that you saved a life. And by doing that, you save many lives, because all the generations that came after them who were able to live as Jews and to be part of the Jewish community and to live in many cases. So we have, I was privileged to then start the Conference on Soviet Jewry. I worked there for 6 years, and when they created the JCRC in New York, the last community really to be organized, but because New York was so big and all the national agencies, they didn't want the competition, but accepted the fact that it became necessary. And it was the Soviet Jewry movement that set the example for them that we could mobilize the communities. Many of the leadership have never visited the communities in the outer boroughs. You know, like Brooklyn was a foreign country. Staten Island was a different planet.
Right.
And so the JCRC, we started with a deficit budget, but we created a really dynamic organization that brought together the local communities, the national agencies, and leadership. And I did 10 years there.
Can I just say for the audience, these are established organizations that feel like they're just part of the infrastructure of American Jewry, but Malcolm actually built it.
We started the Council for Secure America, which I'm very proud of, and then which is an alliance of the oil and gas industry in the Jewish community, and is today flourishing in working in many parts of the country where no Jews ever trade, like Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, South Dakota, the oil patch. We go bring them to Israel. Their elected officials go to Israel. Many of them now are in the government, in fact. And then in 1986, I was asked to take another position to be the executive of the Federation in New York. And the same day, my predecessor at the conference died suddenly. And it was a difficult period till they did a national search and quickly offered me the position. And almost 40 years there, and then I continued to be involved in the conference, and we were responsible for many initiatives, going the first ones to go to the Gulf, the first with the Mediterranean Initiative with Greece, Cyprus, and Israel. Together we did that with Greek American leaders, the SCAN, the Secure Community Network, which I co-founded with Steve Hoffman from the Federations, the JFNA. And so there are many things that we changed the landscape, but I also worked on the premise that you should not be known by what you say you do, but what you do. So I didn't have PR people. I didn't have what I see so many have today, you know, the ability to instantly project and get message out. I wanted the issue to be the forefront and to mobilize as many people as possible, young people in particular, to the causes that we cared about.
I just want to go back to something you said, because the movements that you build, right? What's the key ingredient? Because Dan and I talk about this a lot when we're explaining like what we're trying to build, right? We actually use the Russian Jewry movement as saying like we want to do something similar to that, because that was the epitome of mobilization. I grew up in Riverdale, and I remember as a youngster, you know, like, I was involved, you know, with my shul, the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale, Rabbi Avi Weiss. And I remember when Natan Sharansky came, he came to Riverdale, and I sat with him. And it was like the community was behind it. But there was, like, a moment where you had to build that movement. What was that key ingredient in building the movement?
You actually answered the question, and you picked up the right word, movement. I believe that we should not create another organization. I didn't want the conference, the presence, to be an organization. I wanted it to be a place where all diverse views, and I expanded it from 14 members to 52 members, that everybody should look at it and say, there's somebody there who represents me. When I started the JCRC, I made a list of 30 people, very prominent people, many of them didn't play roles in the community per se. And I said, these are the people I want to go. And when I left 10 years later, 29 of the 30 were on my board. But the key was to build a movement, to not to compete for institutional aggrandizement, not to compete for visibility, but to enhance the role of the individual organizations, but showing them that the collectivity is far more powerful than the individual agencies could be. Nobody today can deal with all the issues. None of us have the resources. We can't afford the duplication. We can't afford competition. We hope people will work and encourage each other to do it. But Soviet Jewry became a movement in which everybody could retain their own identity, but work collectively. Nobody could put 150,000, 200,000 people in the streets as we did if they did it alone. But by building a movement, and that's what I think we need today in the battle against anti-Semitism, because we have too many individual initiatives. We're spending well into the nine figures, and we win battles, but we're not winning the war. And I think that it's critical today that we create a movement in which everyone can make their contribution. We're dealing with very technical stuff now, with AI, with, you know, the internet has changed all the rules of the game. So creating a movement for this, and to show that the whole is far greater than the sum of the parts, and that what we have in common is much more than our differences. The problem is that we always pay attention to the differences. The media wants to talk about the differences. They don't want to know. They want to know when man bites dog, not dog bites man. So it was important to give them a common enemy, me. So that helped unite them. But I have to say, people say I have a storied career, that I was very fortunate, because people, I think, saw, you know, beyond the institutional interests, that we were trying to build something that benefited everybody, and try to not keep it, you know, ideologically limited, and to show that right and left could come together, Reform, Orthodox, Conservative, that you create an atmosphere of respect. It's not, unity doesn't mean homogeneity. It doesn't mean everybody has to think the same, do the same, work the same. It means they have to work together, because we want the same things for our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren. And I look at mine, children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, and I worry a great deal. And I don't know what kind of world they're going to actually inherit. So I feel compelled now to work harder and more, even though I didn't think it was possible, because I think we're facing critical times when leadership has to take gut out front and say, we're going to hold people to account. We should do a doge of our institutions to check that the money is being spent properly and most effectively. I'm not saying people are doing anything wrong. I'm saying that we have to do zero-sum planning like corporations would do it, and the approach. I sit on boards of some companies because I learned so much about how our institutions and our organizations have to function and to be held to account as you would corporate leadership.
So that leads us to the next point, all connected really, which is pre-October 7th. I think your efforts for the five, six, seven decades and many others were so successful that it allowed organizations to really kind of grow and blossom to such an extent that each maybe felt that it was its own self-contained entity. And therefore, after October 7th and October 8th, it was exposed, the disjointedness of our community and our, let's just say, lack of cohesion in our ability to respond. And so now there's been a recalibration coming back to this point of so many individuals who are otherwise uninvolved. Hopefully a recalibration of those in charge of these major Jewish organizations. We'll find out. Some yes, some no. But there's so many exciting, interesting things happening. And part of the reason we invited you is to sort of ask you what you have witnessed, what you see. We've often spoke privately, and you've told me then the amount of different individuals and groups that have, you know, popped up, wanting to do something. You sit sort of at a cross section between, you know, major Jewish organizations, the grassroots, and we wanted to ask you if you could sort of give us an idea of what you've seen in terms of this recalibration, and just give us an idea of what's out there.
So it's a very complicated question, because there are many aspects to what you're asking. I do believe October 8th was a watershed, October 7th and 8th. I see many October 8th Jews people who had no association beforehand, including leading figures in the community, some motivated by what they saw, what they heard, by what they hear in their own boardrooms, where Fortune 500 company leaders will call me up and say, they say it in my boardroom, they make anti-Semitic comments. Some because they saw what happened to their children in public schools across the United States because of the exposure about what happened on the campuses, the blatant hatred, the animosity, anti-Semitism, and the failure to speak up and to act in response to it. It was a wake-up call for a lot of people, not everyone, but for many. And I think that we have to learn how to take advantage of that to enhance the relationship with them, that we not lose these people, but provide new opportunities, and maybe we need new vehicles that will appeal to them. We have a whole different ballgame because of the internet. We're fighting, you know, hidden enemies that you don't see, but the bots that create, you know, change public opinion and create false narratives and impressions to the all the influencers and others that can just spread lies and distortions about Israel and about the Jewish community. And what took Hitler months to spread the big lie is done in nanoseconds today on the internet. Mm-hmm. So all the rules and the challenges we face really have changed, although the basic hatred and I would say even the directions are, we can learn a lot from the past about how you deal with it. And I think one of the things that's unique about us as Jews is that we look back in order to look forward. For us, history is about the future. That we learn how do we protect future generations. We don't get lost in history as some of the radical groups do. What we do is we try to see the positives and negatives of history. Where did they succeed? Where did they fail? We see it in our Bible. And the Torah teaches us about the challenges that our forefathers and foremothers faced. How did they deal with them? And what do we derive in terms of what we have to do? Look at the model of anti-Semitism. Abraham was told you can't live amongst us as a Jew. Isaac was told you can't live amongst us. Jacob, that you can't live. The three prototypes for anti-Semitism through all the generations and all time. And the story of Egypt, the Pharaoh says, you know, it doesn't say the Jews did anything wrong. He said, we have to deal shrewdly with them because maybe if we are attacked, they will join our enemy. There's no sign that the Jews, and they accuses them of doing nothing wrong. It just creates this hypothetical case, which becomes a basis then to enslave people who live with them for generations and contributed so much to Egypt. So we, number one, we look back and learn and build on that past, but also confront a new future, a new current situation, and anticipate what the challenges will be for the future. This is not going away. The anti-Semitism and the hatred moves from country to country. It moves across memes. It crosses oceans and mountain ranges. There's no way to contain it. We have to fight it. We have to force it back under the rocks. We can't cure it. You know, we haven't found a cure for cancer. We haven't found a cure for anti-Semitism. But we can make it unfashionable. We can force universities and others to treat it as they would hate against any other group. That we hold to account faculty and students who engage in unacceptable behavior, that we hold elected officials to account if they have failed to act, those who didn't support the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act or those who didn't, you know, implement the IRA or adopt the IRA definition, and so many other things that governors, mayors, city councils, local officials, police, law enforcement, all of them have to be held to account. Mm-hmm. And not in a hostile way, but to say this is what happens to the Jews is always a bellwether. Well, I'm sick and tired of being the canary in the mine. I'm sick and tired of a world that is very good at mourning dead Jews, but not ready to stand up for living Jews and a vibrant living Jewish state. I want them to do that. I don't want any more of their crocodile tears.
I just want to add something that was, you know, while you're talking, we had the opportunity to speak to high school students last week. And one of the high school students were telling us that, you know, they're on TikTok all the time. And basically what they said was, we're just inundated with, like, anti-Israel, like, constantly. Like that's where they get their news. They're not getting their news from Fox or from CNN. It's TikTok, right? And going back to, like, you know, who's standing up, we have, like, you know, we have these influencers. You know, most recently, like, you have Dave Portnoy, coming out, right? Like, we're seeing those types of people who are deciding to make that, going back to that movement of saying, like, we need to stand up. We're not going quietly.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
And, you know, one of the things that inspires me, right, and as we're all talking, is that there is this, you know, we call it a recalibration. And then there's that saying, like, we have to get up now. Like, you can't sit on the sidelines. It's like, it's enough.
There are no sideliners today anymore.
Right.
Because you may not personally relate,
right,
but your grandchildren will hold you to account. You know, 80 years ago, the world said they didn't know,
right,
which is end of the Second World War, the Shoah. It wasn't true. They didn't want to know.
Right.
They knew everything. They had broken the Nazi codes already in 1942. They knew about Operation Reinhard, when 2,200,000 Jews were killed in Sobibor and Lublin and six other camps. It wasn't that they didn't know. They didn't want to know. The media didn't want to know. Most of them did not report it. It was page 46 in a small paragraph. But if you check and you see that they had the information, today we know everything. And the question is, and we're not going to have a cloak of ignorance to try to hide beneath, and we will be held to account as previous generations were. The question is, will we have a good answer? What you've done with Emissary is one of the answers, and what others have done, the NCRI and all these other groups that are doing amazing cutting-edge work. But also those in the front line, the teachers who are in public schools, and the students who are facing terrible situations, I mean, really horrific. The faculty in universities who are being forced out and who are being harassed and maltreated. Students who face physical assaults and stuff. We have to be there for every one of them. We have to be locus parentis, when kids are on dormitories or campuses outside. Every community should adopt a campus and work with them and invite the kids for Shabbat meals and let them know that the community will stand with them and be with them. So that whenever there's an incident, we should have a way, like Hatzalah, to send out an alert and say, we need people to come to this and this place right away.
And that's part of what Emissary wants to do, is to create that network, which allows us to share when an event occurs. Let's just say an event occurred, let's say at NYU, for instance. If we had tens of thousands of people in the New York area, we could theoretically send them a notification, say, hey, show up to this place at this time.
And even if only 1,000, even if only 500 show up, there was a case where four guys, well-built Jewish guys, walked through a campus, and everybody all of a sudden started moving apart and moving away.
That's right.
We need that ability to be able to mobilize people, to be there, if God forbid somebody is hurt or somebody is challenged. You know, we have students who tell about their dorm doors being set on fire on a Friday night or being beaten up coming home from a Shabbat meal at the Chabad house. And universities universally did nothing.
You know, I just want to say, to be fair to this conversation, you know, before you got in the room, I was talking about my activity back at NYU between 98 and 2002. And, you know, I went on to the private sector. The people who were my adversaries, today I call them my enemies because of the way they act and the things they say.
Right.
But at the time, they're more like, all right, we used to go out for a beer afterwards, actually, at that time. So we were adversaries. But, you know, what happened was I graduated, I moved on. They never moved on. They continued being active. They continued building relationships with other causes.
Because they were paid, they didn't have to make a living because they received money. Many of them from the outside.
But also, when you're hungry, you act.
Right.
When you're satiated, you're calm. And they're hungry, and so they've been acting. And there's money coming. It's a combination of many things. But my point here is they've been working for 30 years, and I'll speak of myself, just woke up to this. And many of us have just, you were already calibrated. You've been talking about this problem for many years. People like myself and others, we've just woken up to this. And so there's a lot of work for us still to do, a lot. And so
But that's the hopeful side, that guys like you and many, many others, young people, are getting involved, are looking for solutions, who have much greater knowledge than I, like the internet. You know, I'm too old to understand much of it, and AI, I understand, but I'll never be able to use it the way you and others can, that we have to get modern technologies, we have to be on the forefront, you have to be able to relate to the young people. And you with Emissary, I know that's one of your goals, but all of us collectively have to do it, and nobody should see it as competitive. Right. It don't diminish anybody. We enhance each other if we do that.
Well, then how do we do that, Malcolm? Tell us. Tell us.
What's the secret sauce here?
No. Well, I think you've done it. I think you have done it by your reaching out, going right into the schools. Nobody else is doing that, I think, certainly more limited. There are people who do it on political grounds and others to mobilize, to educate them, to be involved politically. What you're doing is even more. And one of the things that we do is to fight the curricula that exist in a lot of the public schools and the campuses. Nobody would believe it if they would read the text that actually people use. There's one system, one curriculum that 8,000 schools were using, and now it's been withdrawn. It was blatantly hostile, blatantly.
We just had an election in New Rochelle, which my older brother was very involved with. I was involved in a much smaller way. But basically, they won, the school board, fighting back against this curriculum, this radical curriculum of, they call it radical care, literally they call it radical agenda. Like they're trying to change it, a lot of things. And so
the whole woke agenda and the critical race theory, all of these things that they have imposed on kids. I think people should be free to think what they want. They should be exposed to different points of view. These are not legitimate points of view. They're being exposed to radical things. Some of it, why are the Chinese government official and supporting a lot of these enterprises? Because they want to undermine America. This is right. About America's future. It's not Jews are the battering ram that we get hit first, but it's about America's future. Right. And they know that if you disrupt society, you undermine the foundations of America, the foundations of our democracy. If you educate a generation that is not interested in facts, that can be so manipulated and be told all of these lies, what Israel is doing, what's really happening around, you find out that so much of it was not true. But you have bots that control the letters going to the White House. Mm-hmm. We found one case where 80% of the letters on an issue related to Israel were generated by bots. Mm-hmm. It wasn't real people behind it. And most of the people don't even know about bots yet, and they will. Mm-hmm. But public opinion is being shaped, and then elected officials get affected by it because they think there's all this sentiment.
On that note, there used to be this idea, tell me if I'm wrong, that if you send a letter out to a congressperson, that counted like 1,000 people.
That's right.
Right? I believe that that's changed. Now, politicians look at social media. They look at the conversation. And that's where they get the idea of what people think. So it's not just individuals, it's politicians, it's educators, they're all looking on social media. Right.
And they look at the polls that come about because of the social media.
So now if you send them a letter, it's just a letter. It's one person. They're taking their cue from what they see on social media, and that's why it's so important for us. So the bots are part of the conversation. There are many parts to it, but another important part is the power of the individual. The individual to come together with other individuals, to act together to amplify their voices. And that's sort of like what we're...
And if they only understood how powerful they are. Right. If each individual understood the difference they can make, and then if they get members of their family, they go to their synagogues, to their schools, to others, and mobilize the people there to write. You can change things. I saw one guy change a major news report in the course of a national broadcast by calling up the station and saying, you got it wrong, but the network office, and saying, you got this all wrong, showed him the evidence right away, and before the broadcast was over, those days it had a half an hour broadcast, they changed it. They admitted that they had made a mistake on it. Mm-hmm. And there's so many things that public officials, most elected officials, they can't deal with everything. They deal with 7,000 pieces of legislation a year. So it's the squeaky wheel theory that where they hear from their constituents and where they get pressure, they will respond. If the pressure is only coming from a limited number of activists who have outsized voices because the media loves to do it and they love to inspire conflict. If they are the dominant voice, then you're right. That's what influences how people will act. We have to see to it and look at what they're doing in places across the United States, introducing Sharia law, trying to, they elect people as city council members. They elect people to be committee delegates to conventions. We didn't do that. And we're not doing enough of that to inspire young people to go into elected office, to get involved in campaigns. People in invite the elected officials to your synagogues and say to them, what are you doing? I don't know what the standard speech. Tell me actually, what did you do on anti-Semitism? How did you vote on these key bills? What did you do on Israel? How have you worked to bring constituents together?
And that's the power of like mobilization and all of this, right? If you can, again, create this movement of saying like your voice matters.
Yeah,
absolutely. Each person matters. It's an important way. It's an important way to understand this whole process of, if you don't speak up, then you're actually part of the problem, right? Meaning that if you feel
absolutely
that like you have to speak out. You know, I spoke with Zach Sage Fox recently. He's one of my heroes, the influencer.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him, like, you know, first of all, how do you do what you do? But he's like, I just want to create something and get it out there, and have a voice in it, right? And that's what's kind of like missing for like in the equation is like these individuals. If it's an 85-year-old or a high school kid, everyone makes a difference. And I think that's where the opportunity is to start fighting back in a coordinated way.
But we have to let people know that they have power, and to empower them, and especially young people, to give them a sense of the influence they could have, but how they have to educate themselves so they make a legitimate case and they know what they're arguing, but also how their voices can make a difference. Most people feel that they don't have the clout mm-hmm. that they in fact do.
Right. Mm-hmm.
In a democracy, your voice counts. Mm-hmm. And if you want to protect that democracy, you better use your voice. And if you want to advocate for the things you care about, it's all more important because you have a lot of people on the other side, less than people think, but louder than their numbers.
And so we were actually surprised when we first went into like having these conversations, especially with younger people. We thought we'd actually have to give them something, a free period or a pizza, whatever it was.
Not a bad idea. Right?
But here's the thing. We heard from principals.
We could have had one here.
Right? I have a banana for you. Right? It's really over there.
But what we heard from administrators, and then we started doing one-on-ones with these kids, they're like, no, I don't need a free pizza. I don't need a free period. I want to do something.
Right.
And for us, listen, we're in our 40s. Like, we didn't know how these high school kids actually think. And when we heard that, it actually also empowered us to be like, okay, like if we don't need to give you anything and you actually want to do something, we're going to give you something to do.
And the best thing they can do is to motivate their friends to become activated. And to your point, you know, there's been a feeling of helplessness among individuals, also to your point.
Right.
And there's a real hunger to do something. We made three assumptions here when we started this emissary thing. One was that the major Jewish organizations would embrace us. Well, that wasn't 100% true yet. It's happening, but slow. The second would be there'd be no problem getting funding because everyone would understand the nature of the problem. Well, that's also been, you know,
slow,
but it's happening, but slow. The third assumption was correct. That assumption was there's a hunger. And if we speak to people and give them this tool, they're going to want it and take it. And that's so far proven to be true. We've been to communities of different kinds, synagogues,
schools,
10 different schools. We're doing a pilot right now with 3 schools right now, SAR Academy, Yeshiva of Flatbush, and Westchester Hebrew High. And we're going to roll it out to to another 12 schools in the fall. And the one thing in common is that people say, we're so happy this... First of all, they say, I can't believe this doesn't exist already. And then they say, we're so happy you're doing it and we want to be part of it. And so that third assumption, which is the most important assumption, that the people, they want to act. And hopefully, you know, with this, we can really have an impact. And so.
Yeah, so I just want to sort of close this out for like your final thoughts. In your vantage point now, in the next 6 to 12 months, where do you see sort of the ecosystem in how we can fight anti-Semitism, anti-Israel in a more effective manner? What do you see like sort of in this large scope that you have?
Yeah, predictions are very difficult, especially about the future. And sometimes we don't even know the past correctly. Look, we're in a very dynamic time. We have global challenges and domestic challenges. I think we have to take advantage of some of the things that have happened, the focus on the universities, holding the leadership to account, to go into in each city, into the public school systems, to have mayors who say the right things at times but don't act by appointing chancellors of the board or heads of the boards of education or members of the boards of education, many of the university boards, especially state and public universities. There are so many opportunities for people to get involved and serve. And you know, the challenges that we see today are only going to be magnified. because we see that our opposition and those who are trying to spread the lies and the distortions and misrepresentations have an increasing platform because of their manipulation, because the press doesn't check things. There are no more reporters. There aren't, they're diminished so much. The news coverage is diminished so much. And you have such a variety of sources on the internet that, and there, as you said, kids are flooded then on the sites they go, TikTok and, even Twitter and other things. So we have to be in all of those places to make sure that they get the right information. I'm hopeful that the war in Gaza and stuff will come to a close at some point. I hope that we will confront and deal with the core problem of Iran, which is behind so many of the other challenges. There are hopeful signs and there are challenging signs on the horizon right now with other countries in the region. But the Abraham Accords have sustained. I believe that the people will rally to it when they see the benefit. I believe that we can expand it greatly. But most of all, here at home, we have to go roll up our sleeves, get our hands dirty sometimes, going after public officials in responsible and respectful ways, get them to understand the nature of the challenges that we confront and why it's in their interest and why it's in interest of all the communities, why minority communities and others have to understand that these kind of challenges are going to affect them as well. And it's going to affect the majority society. And if we want our cities to function, if we want our society to function, our country to function, we have to deal with those who are trying to uproot it and challenge democratic principles, who are trying to introduce in the curricula of schools things that will turn our kids into progenitors of hate and distortions. Society cannot function on those grounds. And those who are doing it want to see America fail. They want to see us pitted against one another. So I think in the coming months, the challenges will be as great as they are. I think more and more people will come to realize that they can play a constructive role, and the success of Emissary and many of the other initiatives that are going on and working together, getting the message to people, getting them involved, finding ways that each in their own way, you can't tell somebody what to do. That has to come from within them. We can give them the opportunities for them to get involved. And not everybody should be expected to believe the same, and we don't write off people because they believe differently unless they profess views that are harmful and evil and project this evil that we see in so many places on our campuses and in our high schools. We have to hold elected officials to account beyond just the platitudes. We have to hold those who are responsible for educational systems, etc., throughout all aspects of society. It's commercial, it's political, it's the academic world, it's the entertainment world. When you have all these entertainers who have so much influence over young people saying hateful and bigoted things, they have to be held to account. And I think more and more people are getting it. God willing, more will. Your success, the success of all these efforts, are vital for people who want to see a better future in America.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My
Thank
pleasure.
You for coming.
Appreciate it.
I should mention our app is called Emissary 4, the number 4 all. If you want to download the app and be part of this movement, you should definitely consider doing that. And Malcolm, thank you again so
much.
My
pleasure.
Really appreciate it.
It's good to be with both
of
you.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for what you're doing. And God willing, you'll have great success.
Thank you.
So this was our first episode.
Yeah.
And it was amazing.
Pretty good.
A lot of fun.
Yeah.
Special thanks to Donnie Zoldan.
Yep.
Who really helped us put this together.
And Pat.
And Pat. Thank you, Pat. And this is the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, this is the beginning of something amazing. And I like to say, we need to take moments. And this is a moment for us.
It's a moment. And we're going to share more about Emissary. And we're going to share more about different groups and organizations and what's happening and the positive stories as we move into the future. And so this is just the first, and we look forward to seeing you guys again soon.
And to download the Emissary app, you can go to your Google or Apple store and type in Emissary, number 4, all, and become part of this movement. Thank you.
Thank you.